Welcome to 20 Minute Tabletop, a podcast where we talk about board, card, miniature gaming and all kinds of hosts of topics each week. Tonight we're going to be talking mainly about the topic of Kickstarters, and before we do that though, I just wanted to catch up with Kev about a few of the things we've discussed on some of our previous podcasts. How are you doing, by the way, Kev?
I'm good, thank you. We've got quite the back catalogue now. Notably, one of the last ones I really enjoyed, one of yours, was talking about Horror on the Orient Express, which I'm sure we'll come on to later on when we get into the Kickstarter. But there's been a few things going on. You've notably played Gaslands, the miniature combat Mad Max style toy car game. How do you find that?
It was incredible. I mean, we've not actually spoken about this yet. What I loved about it is it reminded me of, you know, the A-Team from the 1980s TV show with Face and Hannibal and, is it Mr. T? That's right, isn't it? It reminded me of that. It was like grown men turning up with vehicles that they kept in their shed for about 2 or 3 days and then came out and they were armoured up and tanked up in different ways. And one of my friends had built a motorcycle with a battering ram on it, which he later discovered was an illegal thing. And that motorcycle was on the table for less than 30 seconds, but the joy it gave him to roll 97 different dice and take out my friend's car. But it was ridiculous. Just, you know, we were playing on wood that my friend had got out of his shed and with all these kind of hand-painted cars. And it was, I've got to say, like, winning and losing the game was an irrelevancy. What I wanted to know from you, actually, is do people play it seriously? That's the question I had for you about Gaslands. Do people actually take it seriously, or is it just carnage? Is that what it is normally like?
Yeah, I think it's just a fun game. No league or competitive element. I don't think there's ever been, you know, a formal competitive league or anything. But a lot of people play campaign-style games. So they'll, much like Blood Bowl, will chain together a number of battles and they'll get attached to the cars in their group. But your reference to the A-Team is absolutely perfect because, in theory, there's a lot of violence in Gaslands, you know, battering rams and guns and mines and all kinds of stuff. But you never really get the feeling that death is imminent. Like in the A-Team, there's a lot of bullets fired. I don't think you ever actually see any death or injury in the A-Team. It's much the same with Gaslands, but it's a lot of fun. So you actually played with the model cars that had been modified. They weren't just straight out of the toy box. You'd actually gone to some effort to make them look Mad Max, had you?
Well, everybody else had, apart from me. But that led to a real kind of comedy moment because I literally had to raid a donut car it was a donut set or an ice cream van out of a kid's toy box. So it was really juxtaposed, all of these big armoured vehicles with little, you know, they did a really good job of it, actually. I think I posted some pictures on Instagram or if anybody wants to see what my friends did, but I can't take any credit for any of that. And you said there's like Mario Kart version, is that right, that you can play? Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I absolutely want to do that. Yeah, I think there's some custom rules on there where it's basically the same set of rules, but instead of, you know, caltrops and mines and things like that, you've got the spiky shells and the giant mushrooms and things. But coming back to the ice cream van, I think there is actually in the Gaslands core rulebook specific rules for ice cream vans. And I think one of the key weapons is like annoying siren. So you can roll some dice, switch your siren off and distract all your opponents. So maybe you're a little bit more thematic than you realise there, Tom.
It's funny, isn't it, really? Because we're going to be talking about Kickstarters later on. And, like, Kickstarters are the most, or often, are the most overproduced, high-level, so much plastic, so much cardboard, massive boxes. And to play a game that resulted in, you know, just taking stuff that you already owned and playing on pieces of wood. People were using 3D printed and writing on paper stats. It was really nice in that regard as well.
Yeah, the DIY punk feel, you know, the fanzine that your mates have stuck together and given to you in a car park somewhere. It's got that kind of feel. No, I really love it. And it is just a book at the end of the day, isn't it? You supply all the gaming pieces. And I'm sure we're going to touch on the Kickstarter discussion. You know, the commerciality of the modern board gaming world, it's a massive industry. You know, it's millions, tens of millions. And this is just a book. You provide the creativity. And I really like that about it. Which is good. And another one of your podcasts that I enjoyed, Tom, was about solo games with Norm. That was a cracker. Have you had a chance to try any solo games?
No, I haven't tried anything. I did make a promise at the end of the podcast that I was going to try Ark Nova, but I will definitely get onto that. You've had far more experience of playing solo than I have. What did you make of it all? I mean, as a listener and as, you know, as somebody who's played solo games.
Yeah, well, the podcast was excellent. Norm is hugely knowledgeable about it. I'm going to make a note to check out some of his back catalogue, and I believe he's got a Discord as well, which no doubt you'll link to in the show notes for this one. But yeah, I've been a solo gamer for, I suppose, technically, time immemorial, from setting up HeroQuest as a child and playing through campaigns. I was the only person I knew that played miniature war games for a long, long time. So I would just set up a battle and play both sides of it and wade through the pages and pages of rules. So I suppose that's where the solo urge has always sat with me, and especially being an only child as well. I rediscovered it post-university. Actually, I had a friend that I lived with, and we played a lot of Necromunda, old-school Games Workshop specialist games, to things like Man of War and Blood Bowl 2nd Edition at university, and that was a great time. But again, after that, after having that taste, there was a little bit of lull in that early professional career, and I think the first game that I tried, it was called Zombies. I don't know if you remember this.
I do. It had 3 exclamation marks at the end of it, didn't it?
Yes, and a million expansions. Like, unnecessarily. But there was tiny little army men-style plastic zombies and a tile layout. And I thought that was great. And that was soloable to some degree. But then in latter days, I mean, solo's become very trendy now. You know, and as Norm was saying, the stigma has completely gone. And for a while, again, hinting at our Kickstarter conversation, I just had a Kickstarter saved search of solo games, and it was every single week. It seems to be you can't release a game now without it having a solo mode. But my particular love is small box solo, and particularly the ultra tiny, or, you know, the card box, like a poker style deck of cards. Any game that fits in that, I love that kind of stuff. And I've just backed Buttons and Bugs, actually, off GameFound, one of the Kickstarter crowdfunding alike platforms. And that's in the post, apparently, now. So there'll be an episode coming on that. Buttons of Bug being, of course, the Micro Gloomhaven standalone expansion.
Yeah, I was surprised you backed that, actually, because I know you weren't the biggest fan of Gloomhaven. But so when you went in for that one, I was quite surprised. But I'm quite interested to hear what you make of it.
Yeah, well, my logic is, whether you like Gloomhaven or not, I can't help but feel it's an important game in the hobby, to sound very pretentious. You know, your long-fringed, moody teenagers will talk about seminal albums. I think Kickstarter's, you know, it was one of the first multi-million pound fulfilled games, wasn't it? The original Gloomhaven. It's got a place. So many people love it. I did try the original Gloomhaven, thought it was fine, then bought Jaws of the Lion because I just didn't need that much game in my life. That was one of the, you know, to stereotype the Kickstarter genre, you know, the ultimate bloat, huge box, enough campaign to keep you going until you're 70. And Jaws of the Lion was fine. I think I probably didn't do it justice by playing it two-handed solo. So it was very admin heavy. And I know that a lot of people who love Kickstarter now, certainly some of my friends, play the online version on Steam, or there's another platform. I think you've played it, haven't you?
I've only played a couple of rounds of Jaws of the Lion, so I'm very much amateur. You know, I may have had one or two games, but it is interesting to me that my friend, who's part of my gaming group, plays Gloomhaven regularly, plays maybe once a week. He's got a slot on it, but he's got the massive box, but he actually chooses to play online, which I've heard is really, really good version of Gloomhaven. It does all the admin tasks for you and you get the core game experience. So I do want to try it.
Yeah, that's to me sums up the experience. Of my experience, I know people love it. It's not for me to criticise it, but the admin was just too much. So I'm hoping to have that iconic game brand of Gloomhaven in a small, digestible, fits-on-a-coffee-table experience.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what you make of it, to be honest. And finally, just before we do get onto Kickstarters, I just wanted to talk to you about Netrunner. And is it 2 Radio 1 style, which is a British radio thing, to say shout-out to Null Signal Games? It was really great that they posted our podcast on their Facebook page. It was really excellent. I really enjoyed your podcast, and it kind of gave me a sore feeling as well, because I was there right at the start of the re-release of Netrunner, and I remember gleefully buying it. I think Quinns from Shut Up and Sit Down was waxing lyrical about Netrunner week after week after week, and, you know, he was a real voice in the industry that I trusted, and I wanted to get into it so badly. And I remember buying this box and convincing my wife to sit down and play this with me. And it was the longest 3 hours of my life, because I thought, I'm a relatively literate gamer. I can read rule books. I can understand the game. Let's get it on the table. Let's open the rule book. Let's crack on. And it was horrific. Genuinely, I've never experienced a rule book that has made me feel so inadequate as a human being. And I was so upset by the experience that I boxed it back up and sold it within the next couple of weeks. And listening to you talking about how good Netrunner is now, and I knew it was good, but I just couldn't access it at the time. And since then, I've talked to Netrunner players and they've all said to me, oh, no. No, no, no! You can't learn how to play Netrunner by reading the rules. You have to have somebody show you. I thought, what is this, like the Fight Club equivalent of board games? That, you know, you need somebody to invite you into this secret cabal of people that know how to play Netrunner before you can play Netrunner. So, you know, it's really good to hear you talking about it. And you, I know you've invited me to use that online link. What is it? The Jinteki?
Yeah, jinteki.net. But there's a precursor to that. And you're not the first person to have said how inaccessible that original rule book was. The number of people that I've spoken to, now that I know a few people in the scene, they say it was a complete nightmare. And I've come into it much later. You know, the FFG version is long since died. And I'm in this new world of NSG, Null Signal Games. And yeah, it's altogether easier to access. There's lots of online content, video tutorials. There's a brilliant YouTube channel called Metropole Grid, which does walkthroughs not only of the mechanics of how to play, but the thought patterns and getting to understand the factions and things. But by far, the best thing that I've experienced so far is the Chiroboga.net. I think it's .net.au, possibly. If you search Chiroboga Netrunner, you'll find it. And it's a artificial intelligence opponent. And it takes you through from the starter decks all the way up to System Gateway, which is really, really good. And I played that to death, and I can pretty much beat it as often as not now. And I very recently had my first in-person games, and there was absolutely no friction whatsoever. From going from this AI opponent to playing a guy in real life, it was smooth as you like. It was joyful, in fact. So, I mean, times have moved on, haven't they? But it's well worth revisiting. I think I'm going to do it in four parts.
Yeah, do you want to tease what's coming up with the Netrunner podcast episodes? That'd be really good. And just to add, we will make sure we put links to all the websites that we refer to in the show notes if you want to go and visit them. What's part two going to be about?
Well, the first part was just me being excited about Netrunner and saying how amazing it is. The second, I'm going to try and nail it down a little bit more and look at some of the rules. Now, I've got to be careful, and I'm going to disclaim the hell out of it, because I am very much a novice. I'm a new player, so I'm not trying to come across as an expert. But I suppose that in itself has its own value, a new player's experience of a new scene, because there's going to be people who listen to the podcast who think, I want to give that a go. And perhaps they can see it through my eyes as I learn it as well. So the second one, I'm going to look at the rules and actually how, you know, an overview of how a turn works and some of the strategies and the thinking that you'll have to take part in to play the game. And then episode 3, we'll look at the runner. And episode 4, we'll look at the corp, which are the two asymmetric sides of it. So definitely going to try and get some more games under my belt before I hit episodes 3 and 4. But episode 2 is going to be releasing in the next couple of weeks. I'm excited to have a go at that.
Yeah, and it'll be another episode where I listen to it and think, I wish I'd stuck with those rules when I first had the game back in the day. But yeah, let's move on to Kickstarters, eh? And talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's become a massive part of the hobby, hasn't it? You know, as valid as going into a shop and buying a game is backing a game off Kickstarter. I think Kickstarter's been going a good while now, hasn't it? Really well established. And it's a very much a standard way of getting into game systems now.
It is. I mean, I must say, I did resist the temptation of backing Horror on the Orient Express. And they nearly got me, actually, because just after I put the podcast out, I was thinking, the one thing this game doesn't have that I would really like it to have is a campaign mode. And then 2 days later, as a notice, it said, and of course, a lot of you have been asking whether there's a fully-fledged campaign mode. And of course, we've got a fully-fledged campaign mode. I was thinking, oh, no. But I did resist. It was just a little bit too much money for me to part with. And you know my thoughts on having too big a collection. So I didn't do it. And I'm looking forward to seeing it released later on next year to a Board Game Geek rating of 10 out of 10 and living with the regret of that forever. In terms of Kickstarter, you've actually gone through the process yourself in the past, haven't you? And actually released something? I actually genuinely don't know what it is, but you did do it.
Yeah, I did. As listeners are probably aware by now, I've got a business where I produce accessories in the tabletop gaming world, and various things that I want to release, and everything's got to pay its way. So a great way of testing the market for something is to kickstart it. If people back it, you can pursue it. And if no one's interested, then it's good market feedback to drop a product before it goes. So I thought, before I release my tabletop gaming products, there was a tool that I developed for myself called One Task Workbook. I have all these creative ideas and easily distracted, as a lot of designer types are. I work on one thing one day, another thing the next day, and I'll do that for the 30 days of the month, and 30 different projects will go forward very, very slowly. So I thought, I need to nail myself down a little bit and do one task a day and keep it going through to completion. So I developed this like little journal called a One Task Workbook, and it was pretty good, got some good feedback. So I stuck it on Kickstarter, not to kickstart it really. It made a few hundred pounds and it funded, but to understand how Kickstarter works. And I tell you what, it is witchcraft, the actual behind the scenes of running a Kickstarter. So one thing listeners who haven't run a Kickstarter, and yourself perhaps, won't realise is you back something and then you get a pledge manager and you've got to fill out all these surveys afterwards, and you think, why on earth is that? It seems so unnecessarily complicated. But there's a good reason for it, and I'm going to take you through a thought experiment now. So quite often a Kickstarter will have different pledge levels. So they might have $1 to back a project just to get updates, and $100 to get the fully fledged box with the limited edition, the signatures and all the rest of it. So imagine that you've got, in this thought experiment, you've got four pledge levels. You've got a $3 pledge level, $4, dollar, and seven. Three, four, six, and seven.
Yep.
Okay. So okay. You've got one customer that backs the pledge levels of the backer, a $3 level and a $7 level. Total pledge, $10. You've got another backer that backs the $4 and the $6, $10 pledge level.
If this is going to be a maths question at the end, I'm not in anymore. Are you going to ask me some basic maths at the end?
I'm not. I'm going to demonstrate the ridiculousness of this internationally known brand of Kickstarter, how basic it is behind the scenes. So you've got two different pledge levels, totaling $10, which have got wildly different things. You've got a 3 and a 7 and a 4 and a 6, both totaling $10. The creator just sees that these two people have backed at $10 pledge level. Doesn't tell them what they've backed, even though there's four things that they could have chosen from. No feedback whatsoever. It's not like a shopping cart where they've ordered A, B, and C.
Yeah.
Just a random $10. So hence all of the aftermarket, fill out the pledge survey, update your address. It's not an e-commerce platform. And that's something that's quite often present on the comment sections of failing or failed Kickstarters. So I backed a 3D printer back in the day called Build One, the $99 3D printer. And it was a little FDM printer, $99, and it used some interesting technology. I backed it. And then project creep kicked in and it got bigger. And then they wanted an extra $50 for this add-on. You know, they were, let's have a sensor on. Oh, it's $100. And I ended up being in for about $200 in the end. And it was basically the guy got away with the money, $700,000. And he refunded maybe 10.
Blimey.
It was borderline fraud. I got mine back. As soon as I saw the project creep kicking in, I noticed, I thought, this is dying. And I got my money back while the offer was on the table. I was one of the few people that did, which was good. But one of the things in the Kickstarter discussion forums, which get quite fruity when things are going badly, is people say, this is not a store. This is not Amazon. You are backing to support the idea. The creator is under no obligation whatsoever to give you anything. You're just supporting them with some money, and as a favor almost, they're going to give you a return on that. And that is the refrain that you see throughout Kickstarters that are going pear-shaped, is it's not a shop. Don't expect products. If you want a shop, go to Amazon.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, the actual I kind of agree and don't agree with that, because of course no one's going to, well, I mean, some people back low pledge values, but no one's backing $100 board game plus expansions when they're promised board games and expansions and not expecting to get it.
Yeah.
But I do think if you're going to get involved with it, you've got to be prepared not to get your money back, because that's certainly happening. So and there's, you know, a litany of failed Kickstarters. So people have lost thousands of dollars. There's another CNC mill project. I mean, my original background is being an engineer, so I take a bit of an interest in CNC milling and turning. And there was an enormous CNC project that fulfilled, again, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Guy disappeared overnight. Had some good videos, no product in the end. So it's almost rife with fraud. And I think if you've been involved with Kickstarter for a while, you get a feel for what's going to work and what's not. But
yeah,
if you're going to do it, delays and potential fraud are there in the offing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I did go onto a subreddit reading about some Kickstarters, and there are some named companies, which I obviously won't name, but they just said, just don't back it. This is their fourth Kickstarter and they haven't delivered on the first three. And you'd think that there would be some quality control on it. And possibly there is. I'm coming from a position of no real knowledge of the legal frameworks of how Kickstarter work. But it does seem, is it really as stark as you say, that people can just promise something and not deliver with no clawback from the consumers?
Yeah, there's some nebulous terms on the Kickstarter that say you may be liable. But you know, you have a quick YouTube search. There's channels dedicated, big channels as well, dedicated to fraudulent Kickstarters. It is rife. But I think, again, you know, due diligence. If it's a renowned publisher and it's someone you support, then, you know, by all means, back it. One of the successful Kickstarters that I backed was Nemo's War by Victory Point Games, which has now sadly died a death. Victory Point, I don't know, are you familiar with that publisher?
No, I'm familiar with Nemo, though, the little fish. I can imagine it's...
a Captain Nemo, this is, from 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But yeah, that was a success. Well, Victory Point Games were brilliant. They started off laser cutting the products, and they actually shipped their original games with like a serviette, a napkin, and you wiped the charred laser dust off the side of the laser cut card components. You know, real type company. And they grew to something quite impressive. And Nemo's War was, I might argue, the kind of the very pinnacle of their achievements. It was fantastic, beautifully produced. And I backed that and it went off without an issue. And because I believed in this company and I loved what they stood for, and I could also, I'm a laser cutter, got a small business in the game space. I saw a bit of myself in these. These were me, a more successful version of me, 5-10 years down the track. I thought, I want to support this. And if it didn't fund, I was totally at home with losing my money on that. But we're talking £40.
Yeah.
We're not talking the thousands that people put into 3D printer projects and things like that.
Yeah.
So no, I've had quite a few good experiences from Kickstarter. The one bad one that I could have had, that Build One 3D printer, I managed to get my money out, but I was one of the few that did.
Yeah.
But that, yeah, I just think if you're gonna get involved with Kickstarter, you've got to be aware of the risks.
Yeah, I've only backed one myself, which was for the big box version of Escape Curse of the Temple, which came with lots of modular units and also shipped with a free game. And it was Queen Games. And obviously, I think they printed a game that obviously hadn't sold very well. And they had warehouses full of it. It was called Mammut. It was an odd game, really. It was fine. I played it a couple of times, but it wasn't ever something that you dragged to the table. And it's amazing how quickly you get caught in. I mean, I had that just with Horror in the Orient Express. You know, the marketing is really sharp sometimes for these products. And the way they do the daily reveal, it's almost like you come back every day and you think, oh, well, I quite wanted it yesterday, but now they've done this, I really want it. And then the next day, and even these community goals that they set where they go, look, you know, if we reach this total together, we will get...
Stretch goals.
Yeah. It's a really clever business, really, really clever business model. Do you have any plans of doing another one, or is that ship sailed?
No, it hasn't, and I try and fail, I might add, not to, you know, try and plug my own stuff too much on the podcast, but just to plug my own stuff on the podcast. And I'm working on some Kallax compatible storage modules at the moment for board games, card games, miniatures games, because, you know, small box games and things of that nature are a pain. They just don't fit in your Kallax. So I'm going to be kickstarting that project. I'm calling it CubeCore, There's a bit on my Instagram about it. But yeah, I'm using the knowledge that I learned from the One Task Notebook. And actually structuring the campaign is quite the mathematical challenge because you've got to pick the pledge levels at the right one so you can actually make sense of it at the end as pledge managers. I think I've got a bit of a mental block on it. It's way more complicated than it should be.
Yeah, and if any cynical listener is thinking that this entire podcast was set up in order for Kev to reveal that news, I can genuinely say it was news to me too. I had no idea he actually had another one in the offing. It does sound good.
Well, it took 11 episodes, so we've made an investment of about 40 hours just to get that one little plug in. It was worth it.
Amazing. Okay, well, we'll probably need to wrap up around here. And as per usual, we're just going to thank you all for listening. If you want to help us in any way, that's brilliant. There's simple ways to do it. It's to give us a follow and possibly to rate or review the podcasts. I think we're up to 12 five-star reviews now on Spotify, Kev, which has gone up from 7 when I mentioned it a few weeks ago. So again, that's going up slowly. I mean, it's hardly setting the world alight. I did have a quick look at Shut Up and Sit Down number of five-star reviews, and we've got a way to go, but we've got to start small and build up slowly.
Well, even more than the five-star reviews, whilst they are very helpful and helping us grow and meet new people, which is what it's all about, I've had, you know, a number of lovely messages and emails. I'm sure Tom has as well through various Discords and things like that. Connecting with you guys is an absolute joy. Really enjoy hearing from you. So do make sure you get in touch and we reply to everything.
Yes, we do. We do. We are small enough and unpopular enough as a podcast to be able to latch on to any positive comment or hello that we get from people. Do say hello and we will always say hello back. Okay, well, we'll round up there. And once again, thank you very much for listening.